This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
Temperatures are soaring this summer in the Southern Hemisphere. South America is cooking, setting hundreds of new records. Recently in Australia, Sydney Airport set a new December heat record of 43.5 degrees C, 110 Fahrenheit, the hottest early day in 44 years, and 18 degrees C above average. Australia dreads a horror summer of heat and fire. It is no surprise that Australia leads research into heat and the limits of human health. Lessons there will come due for northern listeners in the coming El Niño year. We hear from Dr. Ollie Jay, Director of the Heat and Health Research Incubator. He's at the University of Sydney. He's just published on the limits of human survivability during extreme heat. Doctor and University of Sydney Professor Adrian Gordon joins us to explain her specialty in the care of mothers and the unborn during heat waves. Then filmmaker Nick Breeze wraps it up with Dr. Jack O'Connor, tipping points and interconnected disaster risks. Welcome to Radio with Heat. I'm Alex Smith. Experts may underestimate human risk during extreme heat, especially as Earth reaches the hottest temperatures in more than a million years. And beyond bare survival, what do we need to really live for basic household tasks or even physical work? A new study warns we are not protecting the most vulnerable. This includes babies, seniors, the unhoused, and other risks you may not know about. We have the ideal guest to explain. Professor Ollie Jay is director of the Heat and Health Research Incubator. That's at the University of Sydney. He is a co-author of the paper published November 29th, 2023 in Nature Communications. It's titled A Physiological Approach for Assessing Human Survivability and Livability to Heat in a Changing Climate. From Sydney, Australia, Ollie Jay, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Hi, Alex. Thanks for having me on.
You just had your first early season heat wave in Australia. Absolute temperature records were set last week in China and Korea in what should be the start of their winter. People all around the world experienced extreme heat this year. How would you introduce the purpose of your new heat study?
Well, I think it's important for people to first not just focus on temperatures. So obviously the ambient temperature, which is measured in the shade, is an important consideration. But if we think about the way in which the human body interacts with the environment in order to try to keep cool, one of the other key aspects is the humidity of the air and the ability to sweat. And it's the evaporation of that sweat into the surrounding environment that is the most potent way in which humans keep cool. So when we're thinking about the threat to human health now and the threat to human survival in the future, we need to think not only about temperature, but we need to think about humidity.
For over a decade, experts warned the limit for human survival was around 35 degrees C, measured by something called the wet bulb temperature. What is that, and how was that limit established?
Okay, so it's a 35 degrees Celsius wet bulb temperature threshold. So the best way to think about it is if you have a thermometer and you wrap that thermometer in a wet cloth, and then if water from that wet cloth evaporates, it will reduce the temperature of that thermometer. Now, at 35 degrees Celsius, wet bulb temperature is basically equivalent to 35 degrees Celsius with 100% relative humidity. And at that particular point, there is no heat transfer between the body and the surrounding environment. So we transfer heat between the body and the environment through two predominant pathways. One is called sensible heat transfer via radiation and convection, which is dependent on a temperature difference between the outside of the body, so the surface of the body, and the air. And so when we're fully vasodilated, so we're fully responding to a heat stress, that skin temperature reaches a maximum of around about 35 degrees Celsius. So when air temperature reaches 35 degrees Celsius, there's no temperature difference, so there's no sensible heat loss. But we still have the evaporation of sweat, provided that sweat can evaporate. But if our skin is 35 degrees Celsius and we're fully saturating the skin with sweat and the air is fully saturated with water at 35 degrees Celsius, there is now no humidity difference between the skin and the air, and therefore none of the sweat can evaporate. So basically, all this to say that when we reach a 35 degrees Celsius wet bulb temperature condition, we no longer lose any heat from the body to the environment, and we're constantly generating heat inside the body through cellular processes, which is a part of metabolism. If we can't get rid of any of that heat, we just basically accumulate that heat inside the body to the point where we cook to death. An important thing to keep in mind is that 35 degrees Celsius wet bulb temperature can be achieved through a variety of different combinations of temperature and humidity. So while you get a 35 degrees Celsius wet bulb temperature, 35 degrees Celsius and 100% humidity, you also get it at, let's say, 43 degrees Celsius and 60-plus relative humidity.
As your paper explains, there are two approaches to estimating heat risk. One is to measure actual excess deaths within a few days of the heat wave, basically epidemiology. But that assumes a developed health system that recognizes heat-induced mortality and keeps records, and that's not the case in many hot, humid parts of the world. How does your physiological method work?
Well, the physiological method is not necessarily keeping count of heat deaths. It's basically placing the human body at the center of this model for assessing what the risks are going into the future. So this is really important because the problem from a health perspective is the hot person in the hot environment, not necessarily just the hot environment per se. And so we can find different ways in which we cool people in a warm environment through different processes. But in this particular case, what we're doing, we're saying, okay, well, if we do reach a 35 degrees Celsius wet bulb temperature condition, how does that affect the human body? And are we actually overestimating the limits of survivability? And when you place the limitations of human physiology within the context of the environment that they're exposed to, what we find is actually we're overestimating the limits of human survivability. So in hot, humid conditions, we think that the limit for human survivability is a six-hour exposure to a wet bulb temperature of around about 33 to 33.5 degrees Celsius, so not too far away from the current limit that is being used. But what we find when we get to hotter, drier conditions is that the limitation to the ability to keep cool is no longer the humidity in the environment, it's the ability to produce the sweat in the first place. And therefore, the limits for human survivability due to heat stress, if we're exposed for a six-hour period, are under much lower humidity conditions when that air temperature is much higher. So in this particular case, like I said, the limitation to thermoregulation is the ability to produce sweat in the first place, not the ability of that sweat to evaporate due to the humidity in the environment. And then when we start now integrating certain limitations to the ability to sweat, so you and I and anybody else who's just young, healthy, and fit, we still have a finite ability to produce sweat. But what we know from physiological studies is that as we progressively age, particularly over the age of 65 and especially over the age of 75, the ability to sweat goes down quite dramatically because there are age-related decrements in the ability to sweat. So what we find is that this upper limit for human survivability, the threshold, if you will, is cooler and drier aging as well. So this is a really important consideration if we're thinking about the capacity for us to survive extreme heat across the human lifespan, not just the young, healthy people who have unlimited abilities to produce sweat.
Yes, as we learn, the heat limit is quite different for different ages. In a few minutes, we will hear about dangers for pregnant women and babies from your colleague, Professor Adrian Gordon. Let's you and I go to those most endangered of all senior citizens. Do we know what percent of heat deaths are people over the age of 65?
Well, the epidemiological literature is very clear, is that we know that the risk of somebody either being hospitalized or dying during a heat wave is much more pronounced in people who are older. So people over the age of 65, certainly the risk is elevated substantially, and then that is even more pronounced over the age of 75. But one thing that's also important to keep in mind is that it's not just aging alone. So it's the combination of this physiological vulnerability with the levels of exposure that people are experiencing. And what we know is that people who have older age, they also have comorbidities such as heart disease or kidney disease, for example, that places them at greater risk physiologically. But if they also live in low-resource settings where they don't have access to mechanical cooling like air conditioning, they can't escape the heat, maybe they have limited mobility because that results in a reduced ability to engage in heat avoidance behavior, that really places people at the highest risk. So we shouldn't just be thinking about it along the lines of physiological vulnerability. We need to think about the behavioral adaptive capacity. And when you have those physiological vulnerabilities coinciding with low behavioral adaptive capacity, because the type of settings that people are finding themselves in, and the resources that they have available to them to engage in cooling behavior, that's where it's the perfect storm of vulnerability.
At last official count, Australia has over 250,000 homeless people, and it's probably more in reality. They may not find shelter during the heat wave. Are the homeless a special category of social risk?
Absolutely. So, again, this speaks to that behavioral adaptive capacity. So people experiencing homelessness find it difficult to find shelter from extreme heat during heat waves. And actually, so a member of the Heat Health Research Incubator here at the University of Sydney, Dr. Tim English, is working with St. Vincent's Hospital and the City of Sydney here in New South Wales to develop mobile cooling hubs for people experiencing homelessness to ensure that they have access to shelter, they have access to cool spaces, but also evidence-based guidance on how to remain healthy throughout these periods of extreme heat. And that's a study that is underway this summer, and it's a first-of-a-kind one, as to the best of my knowledge.
Yes, that mobile cooling center hub was just announced by the University of Sydney.
It's the University of Sydney, so Tim English.
Gross survey that I did, a very quick look, seemed to indicate to me that Australia doesn't really have a full-blown cooling center network ready in case the power fails. Is that your take?
Well, I think that, first of all, we need to kind of think about what types of interventions actually work the best. So the evidence supporting the efficacy of cooling centers, certainly in an Australian context, has not been demonstrated to date. What we find and what has been found is that people are quite reluctant to go to these cooling centers. Often they don't know where they are. People would much rather stay either at home or, you know, access other types of support rather than congregate in these cooling centers. So I think the evidence supporting the efficacy of those types of interventions is somewhat limited. And, of course, it may change depending on the type of setting that you're in. So perhaps something that works in a North American setting might not necessarily be as effective in an Australian setting. I think that's something we need to keep in mind before we start advocating necessarily for a large-scale rollout of cooling hubs.
But in 2009, the state of Victoria had a fairly large power outage. What happens when the grid goes down in Australia and all those air conditioners don't keep working?
Well, it's certainly something that is at the forefront of our minds, right? Because we know that the uptake of air conditioning is growing rapidly. We have a frail energy infrastructure, which is really stretched to its limits during periods of extreme heat, where more and more people are reverting to using their air conditioning in order to remain cool. So it is a concern. So some of the work that we've been doing here at the University of Sydney is really looking at what type of simple strategies that people can use if they find themselves without electricity. So one type of strategy which we've been testing is looking at the efficacy of how you should best use water. Now, of course, drinking water is important for maintaining hydration, but you could also apply this water to the skin surface. And the evaporation of that water from the skin surface provides an extra cooling benefit. That's the type of strategy that is being advocated by public health organizations now for people who don't have access to air conditioning or don't find themselves in situations where they don't have access to electricity. Now, another thing that we also need to think about is how do we avoid these blackouts in the first place? Now, upgrading energy infrastructure is one thing, but that's a long-term solution. And it also doesn't really solve the problem of us consuming increasingly greater amounts of energy, which are predominantly generated by fossil fuel power plants. So that's a bit of a maladaptive situation that we're kind of finding ourselves in. So we've been working here at the University of Sydney alongside some of our colleagues in the U.S., trying to look at this idea of a fan-first cooling strategy. And this is where people use fans first, such as ceiling fans or pedestal fans, to blow more air across the skin surface. And what we can do is that cools the body more for a given air temperature. And if you do that first and then set your air conditioning unit to turn on this cooling at 27 degrees Celsius instead of 22 or 21 degrees Celsius. What we find is that people feel just as cool as they did at a cooler, stiller environment with the traditional air conditioning in use right now. But the air conditioner turns on later in the day because it doesn't turn on until it exceeds 27 degrees Celsius. It turns off earlier in the day, and we find that that will reduce air conditioning use by about 70%, reduces electricity consumption by 70%, and places less strain on the grid. It also saves people on their electricity bill as well. So we look at this as being quite a simple, scalable strategy that will hopefully be adopted at scale and really help us build resilience into the community when we're looking at coping with these extreme heat events in the future.
Those are very useful tips. I'll put them in my blog as well. The Australian Council of Social Services found even before the summer begins, 74% of people on income support are cutting back on cooling and heating due to increasing energy costs. And that's the case, too, in America and in Europe. So there's definitely a socioeconomic aspect about who lives and who dies during extreme heat waves.
Absolutely, and I think that's something that is so important for people to keep in mind when we're having this discourse in the general public, is that often it's tempting for people to say, oh, well, you know, you just need to toughen up, cope with heat. And what I think often these people are missing is that actually the most vulnerable are people not like themselves. They're people who have frail health, but they also find themselves living in quite tenuous circumstances. They don't have access to air conditioning. They don't necessarily have access to clean water. They may not have social cohesion. They may not be linked up with people in society. Often the most vulnerable are found dead at home, living alone on the top floor of a non-air conditioning apartment at the end of an extreme heat event. So the impacts of these types of events fall squarely on the most vulnerable, and often the people who are least responsible for contributing to climate change as well. So this is something that's really important to keep in mind. It's also important to try to consider that when we're looking at this as a global phenomenon, is that if we're looking at the impacts of climate change with respect to extreme heat, particularly in lower middle income countries, predominantly tropical environments, again, the type of circumstances that people are finding themselves in there are often not comparable to your average Canadian, for example, your average American or your average Australian. So having that context is vitally important when we're thinking about the larger scale impacts of climate change on extreme heat.
Check out the Radio EcoShock website. We're at ecoshock.org.
From Australia, Alex speaks with extreme heat expert Dr. Ollie Jay from University of Sydney.
We can't just focus on mortality. Everybody has to live, doing a job, getting groceries and all that. And about a quarter of the world population still has to work outdoors to grow crops. We recently heard from our guest, Dr. Connor Dunn-Diaz, about possible crop losses, meaning food shortages, when agricultural workers can't work outside. What did your team find out about limits to livability, and how do you define livability?
Well, in this particular case, in this study that you're referring to, we were really trying to look at it from a more holistic perspective. So the focus in the past has simply been how hot and humid does it have to be before people cannot survive the heat exposure. But what we then kind of reflected on is that in order for a region in the future to be inhabitable, it not only has to be survivable, it also has to be livable. And so to be livable, we need to take into account that people are going to need to engage in physical activities that require higher rates of metabolic heat production, and they may need to take into account clothing. We might need to take into account being out in the sun. You know, all of these limits to date have assumed that people are in the shade and that they're resting at minimal levels of activity. But in order to be livable, you need to be able to carry out simple daily tasks without risking exertional heat stroke. So in this particular study, we basically started to look at, okay, well, what type of levels of activity would be possible in these types of environments in the future, and is that sufficient to be livable? So not only are we looking at the limits of human survivability, we're also thinking about, okay, if it's survivable, what kind of activities are you still able to do in those environments? And what you might find is that under some circumstances, an environment might be survivable, but it's not livable because you can't really do anything in there. You just got to stay still be nude, lying indoors in the shade, which is, you know, not the most of it. So we had we integrated that type of analysis into the paper as well.
The Australian Council of Social Services called the coming Australian months the horror summer, and the Australian Bureau of Meteorology predicts dire heat. With your expertise, Ollie J., when is it time to declare a climate emergency and get busy educating and preparing?
Well, the Australian Medical Association has already declared climate change as a public health emergency, and I think they know that the right signal. It is an emergency, and these very hot summers are already here, and so we need to do all we can to help, particularly the most vulnerable in society, to build resilience, to ensure that they can navigate their way through these extreme heat events safely. But it's also important for us to think about how we can build resilience among the community as a whole without contributing further to the problem down the line. And I think this is where the preoccupation with air conditioning, for example, is a real challenge, because it's often seen by many as a bit of a silver bullet, whereby, as long as everybody has access to air conditioning, everybody will be okay. But the problem is, of course, is that air conditioning is very carbon intensive. At the moment, in many parts of the world, most electricity is generated by fossil fuel power plants. And so what we're finding ourselves slipping into is this vicious cycle where it's hot, we turn on our air conditioners to cope. Those air conditioners are powered by fossil fuel power plants, which belch out more CO2 into the atmosphere, which then contribute to warmer years in the future, which we respond to by using more air conditioning. And so we need to find a way of breaking that maladaptive cycle so we can get to the point where we have a sustainable and healthy path moving into the future.
Yes. Well, what does the Heat and Health Research Incubator do? And tell us about also your thermal ergonomics lab.
So the Heat and Health Research Incubator is a research center. What we do is serve as a platform to enable people from a variety of different disciplines, both within academia and outside of academia, working with the community, working with health, working with policymakers, working with industry, to develop comprehensive solutions to these very complex problems that we face in terms of the negative health effects of extreme heat on hot weather across the human lifespan. Within that, we have five priority research themes. We focus on maternal and child health, physical activity, occupational and sport, aging and chronic diseases. We also focus on two settings where we're developing solutions, so landscapes and the built environment and health, and also humanitarian settings. So that's how we organize all of our research activities. Nested within the Heat and Health Research Incubator, which is a center, is the laboratory which I direct, which is called the Thermal Ergonomics Laboratory. And so we have a state-of-the-art climate chamber within the laboratory where we have the capacity to simulate both heat waves of the past but heat waves of the future as well. So we go to the weather records from, say, the heat wave from Chicago in 1995. We simulate the temperature, the combination of the peak temperature and humidity. We then bring in human participants under safe medical supervision, of course, with a variety of different physiological profiles. So we bring in people as old as 90 years old, children as young as 9. We expose them to these simulated extreme heat conditions, and we measure the effect that these extreme heat conditions have on their physiology. So we measure how hot it gets, how much work their heart has to do, how dehydrated they become. And then it gives us a means to identify systematically the efficacy of simple low-resource cooling strategies for reducing those markers of physiological heat strain that are ultimately responsible for making people ill when they're exposed to extreme heat. So we can test these simple strategies to identify which one is the most effective at keeping people cool, which one's the most effective at limiting the amount of work people's heart has to do, and minimizing dehydration in some cases. So we do a variety of different studies in the lab. One of the other factors that we're doing now is trying to understand the limits of human survivability. So we have the capacity not only to simulate heat waves of the past, but also simulate the heat waves of the future. So the way that works is that we work closely with climate scientists who have a really strong understanding of the way in which the choices that we make now can contribute to different climate pathways in the future. And so we can actually not wait until these heat waves of the future arrive. We can predict what they're going to be with the different carbon emission scenarios that we find ourselves on now, and simulate those different visions of the future with human participants and show the consequences of what those different heat waves of the future are going to do to physiological heat strain and the risk that people will face in the future.
From Sydney, Australia, we've been speaking with Professor Ali Jay. He's the director of the Heat and Health Research Incubator and co-author of A New Estimation of Real Heat Risks. You can find links to the paper and more notes in my Radio EcoShock blog at ecoshock.org. Ollie, thank you for the work you do and for speaking with us today.
Pleasure. Thank you for having me on.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org.
Covering the world, this is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
Extreme heat is risky for pregnant women and babies in the womb. It can be fatal or may increase chances of diseases in the child later. Adrian Gordon is a clinical professor in obstetrics with special knowledge on neonatology and heat. She leads clinical research and co-authored over 100 peer-reviewed papers. From the Faculty of Medicine and Health, University of Sydney, Adrian Gordon, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Good morning, except I don't think it's morning for you.
You never know what time it is somewhere in the world. How serious is extreme heat and humidity for expectant mothers?
Okay, well, we have quite a lot of data now from different countries and different areas showing that the risk of important adverse pregnancy outcomes are increased with exposure to extreme heat. And the sort of outcomes that we are worried about are preterm birth, so going into labour before 37 weeks and having that baby early, which has got its own complications. It increases the chance of babies being stillborn, so dying before birth. And there is also a higher risk of babies being born with low birth weight. So these risks are a little bit different in different studies, but are around sort of 1.2 up to 1.5 times higher in population-based studies that have looked at heat and pregnancy outcomes.
Does the heat affect the core temperature of mother and the unborn differently than people in other stages of life?
So that is an excellent question. And I guess the short answer is we don't have enough data yet actually know if this is a risk that is mediated through changes in core temperature. So we have just recently been funded by the Wellcome Trust to do a study trying to work out exactly that. So along with Ollie Jay and the Heat and Health Research Team at the University of Sydney, we are going to run a study across two different countries, India and Bangladesh, looking at individual measures of temperature and pregnancy outcomes, and then a climate chamber trial where we'll actually measure core temperature when women are exposed to different heat and humidity. So their team ran a study published in Sports Medicine a couple of years ago, a small study, but looking at exercise on a stationary bike in pregnancy with non-pregnant control women, and finds that actually core temperature did not differ in how it increased between those who were pregnant and those who were not. And we need to understand whether this is one of the mechanisms that leads to these adverse outcomes, because it's only if we understand the physiology a little bit better that we'll be able to offer interventions to support pregnant women to keep cool, particularly in different parts of the world like low and middle income countries.
Well, we must know something physiologically about why pregnant women are more at risk than other groups. What do we know?
I think what the hypothesis is that your ability to cool down is compromised when you're pregnant. So we know that you may heat up a little bit more when you're pregnant compared to when you're not, because you have two people and the fetus generates its own temperature about half a degree higher than the mother's core temperature. We also know that normally you cool down by sweating, and that you actually have a reduced kind of surface area so that to body mass. And that means that your ability to cool down by sweating might be compromised in pregnancy. However, the body is very clever. So actually, pregnancy already does some physiological changes to compromise for the fact that you might be less able to cool. And so some of the more detailed nuances about what happens really have been hypothesized and not studied in humans. So we have a lot of data, for example, from cattle. So we know that for cows, there is a risk of extra heat. There's a risk to heat waves. This can result in the same sort of adverse pregnancy outcomes. We understand a little bit more about the physiology there than we do for pregnant women. And that's partly because pregnant women are often excluded from studies because they are, you know, thought to be a vulnerable population. So we do know that, yet your ability to cool down and how you deal with heat is compromised in pregnancy, but that actually there are some physical compromises that are made, for example, increased blood volume and fluid volume that actually try and sort of mitigate some of those changes. And what we really need to understand is what happens so that we can actually work out interventions.
Adrian, you also specialize in stillbirths. In fact, you are the chief investigator for the Stillbirth Center of Research Excellence. How big is the problem of stillbirths globally, and does extreme heat increase that risk?
So around the world globally, there are about 2 million stillbirths every year. So that's death of a baby before birth. And when we look across the world, the numbers are calculated from 28 weeks of pregnancy and beyond, because that's where the data is collected and stronger. So actually, you know, this is really a sort of an underestimate, because in many high-income settings, we would count these deaths from about 20 or 22 weeks of pregnancy. So I guess at least 2 million stillbirths globally every year, that equates to one baby dying before birth every 16 seconds on a global scale. The risk of heat and stillbirth is thought to be about 1.1 to 1.2, so 10 to 20% higher in areas where people are exposed to extreme heat. Now, that 10 to 20% sounds quite small, but obviously if you apply it to those numbers on a global scale in a world that's heating up, those things are actually going to affect many more people than anticipated.
What do we know about how rising heat levels and heat waves can affect later childhood health and maybe even lifetime health outcomes?
Look, that's a really good question. I guess we know that there are other areas in pregnancy that appear to be affected by extreme heat, like diabetes and preeclampsia. And both of those things have long-term impacts on the child, as does, obviously, preterm birth or being born of low birth weight. So if there is an effect on an unborn baby from a complication to the mother, those complications can have lifelong effects in terms of cardiac health, cardiometabolic health, potentially later life risk of diabetes or obesity for the child. So those conditions, those non-communicable disease conditions, are all increasing globally, and much of that has been thought to do with rises in obesity globally. But many of those conditions are also associated with heat exposure, so they may sort of have an additive effect on lifelong health. We know that, for example, for children, so infants, toddlers, also less able to cool themselves down and may not have the kind of normal voluntary urges that we would have as adults to, you know, drink more water or access somewhere colder. So certainly in extreme heat, younger children are more at risk of heat stress. And that, of course, is important at that life stage.
So moving to Australia and Canada and around the world, now we have heavy wildfire smoke as well. Have you or others studied the effects of wildfire smoke on babies in the womb and pregnant women?
So I haven't done that work myself, but there's quite a lot of work looking at outdoor and indoor air pollution. adverse pregnancy outcome, for example, stillbirth. And there are trials in other countries looking at cleaner cook stoves and stillbirth reduction. And actually a team that have run a study called the Polly Borton Trial are actually engaged in our Wellcome Trust project. So that's Camille Raines-Greeno here at the University of Sydney with the ICDDRB in Bangladesh. They ran a large trial looking at reducing household air pollution. So that's certainly one area that we know is important. And there's also been population-based studies, I think in the US, Canada and Australia, looking at bushfire or wildfire smoke and adverse pregnancy outcomes. There is a risk there. And clearly, with higher temperatures, the risk of those bush or wildfires will also increase. So in our planned cohort study, we will also be measuring air pollution as well as ambient temperature, as well as individual measures of temperature exposure.
So during hot, humid weather, what are the danger signs to watch for in pregnant women?
So if people are feeling hot, feeling faint, that's a perception that they would have, and they should try and seek shade, drink more water, try and be somewhere where there is wind. So we should in general be trying to be somewhere where we're sort of, I guess, cooling the air less, but moving the air more helps a lot. So simple solutions in low-income settings, like a cool rolled-up towel in front of a fan on the back of the neck, would cool people down. We know that if heart rate goes up, that can be a sign that the body is not dealing with higher temperatures. But obviously, not everyone is walking around checking their heart rate. So from a perception point of view, if people are feeling faint or feeling too hot or feeling dizzy or nauseous, then that might be a sign of heat stress. And they should try and make sure that they are well hydrated and can seek somewhere cool if possible. Obviously, in many parts of the world, you know, we have really very effective ways to keep the air cool, as in air conditioning. But for many women, particularly in low and middle income settings, you know, they might be out working in the field, carrying water, doing really marked physical exertion right up until when they have the baby. It's obviously much harder in that setting to try and keep cool, but yeah, hydration, light clothing, less exertion if possible, and somewhere where the air is moving is important for anybody, but particularly for pregnant women.
What do you want governments in developed countries to do to lead the way to help protect the next generation during these climate extremes?
Yeah, well, I think investment into maternal, newborn and child health is very important. As I mentioned earlier, pregnant women are often excluded from these kind of overarching policy areas, from clinical trials that are thought to potentially be risky. And I think unless we actually can have policy that globally applies to pregnant women as well as other adults, we will not be able to protect this population. So I guess it would be a call to ensure that pregnant women are included in policy, that interventions are targeted and tested for pregnant women so that we know they're effective and that they're really thought about in terms of workplace and country strategies in terms of protection, because I think this is not a problem that is going away, and it's a population where we really need to think about protection and prevention and coping strategies.
From the University of Sydney, Australia, we've been speaking with Professor and Medical Doctor Adrian Gordon. You can find links to the news and science we talked about in my weekly show blog, published Wednesdays at ecoshock.org. Adrian, thank you for helping us with these important matters.
No problem. Pleasure to talk.
We just have time for a sample from the Climate Gen podcast with UK filmmaker Nick Breeze. Nick interviews leading scientists for his members and then posts them on YouTube. Find out more at www.gen.cc.
In this Climate Gen episode, I'm speaking with Dr. Jack O'Connor at the UN University's Institute for Environment and Human Security. Jack is the author of the Interconnected Disaster Risks Report that is looking at tipping points impacting human security and the Earth system. The report is available for download via the notes as well as a link to the main website with detailed insights into a number of risk tipping points.
Jack, it's good to meet you. Thank you very much for taking the time today. With regard to this new report on risk tipping points, can you start by specifically defining what we mean by risk tipping points?
Well, with risk tipping points, what we mean is these are points in systems that we use every day. So human systems, our systems we rely on for food, water, but also things in the environment. The first key thing is that these risk tipping points can apply across many different systems. And what we see in these systems that we use is that their risk in these systems is increasing towards a point where the systems will no longer be able to function in the way that we rely on them to. And after their function changes drastically, now new risks can emerge. And that's what we really try to focus on.
Can you use one of the risk tipping points that you use? Groundwater was an example. Can you talk us through how the groundwater risk tipping point can extend beyond its sort of regional setting and become more widespread?
Absolutely. So yeah, the groundwater tipping point example, if we're talking about interconnectivity, there's a few different ways that we approach it. One is that we look into a tipping point to dig back into what we call root causes. And these root causes usually manifest in our behaviors and our values as people. And then stemming from that, we design systems in certain ways, often with certain weaknesses and vulnerabilities that contribute. If we think about the groundwater issue, which is that we're bringing up water from underground to irrigate our crops, this has worked well for a while and helped us to cope, especially in arid areas, to irrigate during droughts, for example. But now we're reaching this point where they're starting to run dry. And some of the underlying drivers and causes for this, things like risk intensifying land use. So despite the fact that we can see the problem coming, we're still pushing the accelerator to extract further and get what we can now, rather than make a more sustainable system. And this kind of behavior also underlies other tipping points in our report. For example, there's one on accelerating extinctions. There are a few underlying drivers, many of which are well known, but underlying these drivers, we also see a desire to extract resources as much as we can without little future planning and without considering the impact of our actions. So these underlying root causes can interconnect cases. But also when we talk about tipping points, once tipping points pass these critical thresholds, now they can increase risk in other types of systems. So for groundwater is an interesting case because it's something we don't see. It's underground. People don't think about it much, but science tells us that underground in these, we call them aquifers, these freshwater reservoirs, there are actually rich, diverse ecosystems also. And so once these things are getting drained, we are also unaware of the impact that it's going to have on these underwater ecosystems, but it can likely lead to less biodiversity, which cascades into further extinctions.
And in the report, or sort of with the report, you do highlight some of the groundwater issues in India. And I've interviewed hydrologists in Italy who are saying that there's a huge sort of deficit if you look at the groundwater like a bank account. Do you think that as we move forward, that we're accelerating the risk for things like agriculture? Is that another way that these systemic sort of interconnections can filter back out and reach people who may think they're immune from these?
We try to focus on groundwater for food and irrigation. Yes, as you say, we do look at India, Italy. I think that another one of the ways that the risk increases is that we rely on groundwater to shield us in times of drought, for example. But when we run out of groundwater, we see that people are now trying to shift back to a rain-fed agriculture. And this is a problem considering the changing climate. Rainfall is no longer as reliable as it used to be. So we're sort of jumping out of the frying pan and into the fire now. And when we need to come and rely on weather patterns to save us, it's just a riskier way to do things. If we see groundwater, if we see ecosystems, and we see some of the other systems in the report as our safety net, as our tools to cope with risk, and as we pass these tipping points, we're sort of cutting these cords and the net is getting weaker.
And so stick with the groundwater. We're talking about agriculture, which food systems, and if a large one of these fails, you said it's not just the local economy, but it's also that community needs to get food from somewhere else. And that puts pressure on other supplies. And these are the ripple effects that we're talking about, aren't we? There's less food to go around globally. These cause shocks to the system.
Yes, absolutely. I think that we're starting to, and I say we, you know, people around the world are starting to understand this more and more. I think the war in Ukraine, for example, people started to understand that we rely on food that is not grown where we are. And that means that something that happens on the other side of the world is a massive problem for us. And while today we might not be directly involved, we don't know about tomorrow. And so we need to really reduce risk in these kind of systems. I mean, we saw for groundwater, this is not a theoretical point. Wells have run dry already in many places like Saudi Arabia. And once they lose this ability, now they're buying up agricultural land overseas, and they're actually buying up agricultural land in places that are getting more stressed, like the American Midwest. So the people there are running out of water, not just due to their own food and economic needs, but also from other places.
Another item which I thought was really interesting was uninsurable future. And obviously, I mean, this can only be relevant in parts of the world that are insurable, which is generally places like Europe, I suppose, and wealthier parts of the world like the US, Europe, etc. Can you talk a little bit about how this impacts us?
To start off with, yes, on the surface, it does have to do mainly with the people that can afford insurance. There is a big push to try and protect as many people around the world as possible with insurance, and it is still challenging to achieve this in, for example, the Global South, and this will become more challenging as we go along. This issue of people no longer being able to access insurance because the damages being inflicted by different hazards and the risk rising due to climate change, now people are losing what they had already. But this problem does then, once this point is passed and an area becomes uninsurable, there are cascading impacts that affect everybody. So, for example, not just homes, but also businesses. If they're unable to get insurance now, it's hard for them to buy or access properties. And they may start to move away from a certain area. And so for the people that don't have the resources to move, you sort of have these areas of high risk with people trapped there without coverage. This also affects government that now has to step in and support more, which draws resources away from other services. So even though on the surface, uninsurability protects the wealthier people, in the end, it will affect everybody.
And we already see insurance companies pulling out of places like California. And I think AXA have warned that there are thresholds to what they see as insurable. I think as temperatures go up, they just have, that's an uninsurable world, etc. This has a huge, you mentioned the cascade potential. This really for countries where people who consider themselves probably quite well off or secure could suddenly see themselves flip into a different status. Do you think that this could be quite a serious impact as we go forward now? I mean, in terms of how we perceive life in the wealthier parts of the world?
I think so. There's an argument to be made that if you have insurance, you may encounter what we call moral hazards. So you're insured and you feel like you can be risky because you have a safety net. where what we're trying to do is get people collectively to step back from taking risky choices. And the people that are waking up suddenly in California and different places in the States to find that they're not covered anymore, it comes as a big shock. And now they realize, I think, more the risk that they're in. So I think the idea is that insurance is one part of a toolbox that can help us to manage risk, but we need to wake up to the fact that even if we have insurance, the risk is still rising, and not just for insured, but everybody. And that's what needs to be taken care of, rather than thinking, okay, I have insurance, I'm good, and then wait till the day it rescinds. And you're suddenly in a very risky situation.
And do you think there's a connection here to loss and damage is basically results of impacts of climate change, and is in the context of climate vulnerable nations who are generally global south and much poorer? But if you suddenly find yourself uninsurable, then you are, your whole life is changed. And it helps us think through some of the real impacts of what we're facing now, is that it's not just those people over there. It's something we've got to consider on a much broader scale. And maybe helping those people over there will help us understand these issues much more widely.
100%. I would support what you just said there, Nick. I think that in order to reduce risk for ourselves, it's important to reduce risk for all. Insurers, actually, the risk has raised so much. This problem of insurability is uninsurability has been coming for a while. And one of the steps they took a few decades ago was to get insurance for insurance companies. So when it's getting too expensive, now you get this thing called reinsurance. And reinsurance covers a much wider area, and that's how they're able to absorb these big costs. But it also means that a disaster that happens far away, if it's covered by the same reinsurer as you, can raise your premiums, even if nothing has happened in your locality. For this reason, and there are various others, I think this idea of collectively reducing risk, having it matter to you what happens to someone somewhere else, helps to reduce your risk for sure.
Yeah, and it just comes back to all of these tipping points, is that there is an interconnected system. Just very quickly, there's one called space debris, and I didn't really know what that meant. Can you just give a very quick overview of what space debris is in terms of a tipping point risk?
Absolutely. The space debris case, it seems to sit a little bit outside of the others, because nobody thinks about space too much. But the risk there heading towards a tipping point has to do with the fact that we're launching satellites, and from now and into the near future, we're looking at escalating that quite drastically. But we haven't yet well regulated, especially the low Earth orbit, which is where a lot of our satellites end up. We don't have good plans to bring down these satellites, and there have been a few collisions and explosions in the past also. That means that the orbit is filling up with debris or space junk. Meanwhile, we're sending up more and more satellites, and there is theorized to be a density where it gets so crowded that if there is a collision, the debris from that will then start a chain reaction that hits another until the satellite infrastructure is basically no longer able to be used by us. And we use these satellites, among other things, to monitor weather patterns and anticipate and give early warning for disasters. So once we lose those eyes in the sky, our risk of all systems goes up. So we wanted to illustrate that and press for the need to transform how we think about using our space around the planet.
How much resource is being put into studying this at the moment, or even coming up with a strategy for tackling it?
I think that there is a lot of resource and strategy. For example, people are looking into ways to remove junk from orbit. It takes a lot of resource, obviously, to do that. In our report, we look especially into solutions and what are we doing, what can we do? And we classify them into solutions that will delay us getting to the tipping point and transform in a way where we can avoid it. And a lot of the solutions that we see, not just in space, but in a lot of the tipping points, is that we found good technological ways to delay getting there, like maneuvering satellites around to dodge junk. But in order to really address it and avoid the tipping point, the challenge is space, like a lot of what we call the global commons, where it's not owned by anyone in particular. There are political reasons, security reasons why there's a lot of distrust between countries. And what we need is to find a way to overcome these for a unified solution among countries to regulate and make decisions on being more sustainable.
This really brings us towards what the part of the report that is a framework for confronting these challenges. Can you talk a little bit about the framework? I mean, the three words that stick out are avoid, adapt, delay. How do you encapsulate all this?
The framework deals with two binary things. So there's avoid, adapt, and there's delay and transform. The avoid and adapt relates to the fact that as much as we want to do what we can to avoid tipping points, some of these are unavoidable. So, for example, we look at mountain glaciers. Some of these we are going to lose. It seems difficult to avoid that happening. So when we think about solutions, yes, we want to avoid, but it could also be time to start learning how to adapt. And then the delay and transform, as I say, the delay of things that we're doing to try to give us more time before things fail. So in terms of glaciers, there are a lot of interesting solutions, like laying blankets on the glaciers to try and get them to melt slower and this kind of thing, which helps. But in the end, the people that depend on these glaciers for their water, and that water is going to disappear in some cases, need to start transforming the way that they use water, start transforming the way that they value water in order to make sure that when the tipping point comes and the water slows down to disappear, that they're ready and they don't face the worst impacts. And it's not just for the mountain communities, but this kind of idea about changing how we value water and other things applies to all of us. It's difficult to change your value when you don't see the immediate impact. So if you turn your tap on and the water comes out, and if we can start to shift how we see things to being precious, to not being throwaway, to not being endless, we'll reduce our risk in a lot of these tipping points.
That was a sample of Nick Breeze speaking with Dr. Jack O'Connor at the UN's University Institute for Environment and Human Security. Jack is the author of the Interconnected Disaster Risk Report on Tipping Points, Human Security, and the Earth System. My thanks to Nick Breeze for sharing his work. You can find more of his great interviews at www.gen.cc. That's GENN.cc. I'm Alex Smith. Thank you for listening and caring about our world.